why we can't have nice things, right?
Yeah, sorry.
You should have said it's fish and they use pellets.
Yeah, this kind of guy.
This cat.
Yeah.
Ask your mother. All right, guys, we ready?
Ready.
Let's do this.
Proper slow.
No.
That's too low of a number. You're right.
Oh, Sean got it. 22. Actually, we're going to do two different proverbs. It's in here twice. All of us thought this was important.
Hey,
Twenty-two.
Hey, Proverbs 22:13.
Let's pick up there. I'm feeling slim this morning. Who are we missing?
We just condensed everybody.
All right. You just squished all of you in together.
13.
All right. 13.
The sluggard says there is a lion outside,
right? Do you really think there's a lion outside?
No.
More than likely not. Now there have been known, obviously, in David's day, there are lions and tigers and bears on my. In Israel, it's happened. Not so much anymore. Why would the sluggard be saying there's a lion outside? It's an excuse. Turn to 26:13. So you're always well caffeinated and funny in the morning. I gotta get at the speed to keep up with you. 26:13, he says it again. The sluggard says there is a lion in the open road, or in the road, the lion in the open square. So this sluggard, for whatever reason, is offering some grandiose excuse. Now, what's the problem with this excuse?
It's lame.
It's not even a good excuse, right? Everybody sees through it. The root of the problem, look at 26, the next verse in verse 14. As the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed.
No.
So where is said sluggard?
Yes.
I can't get out of bed today. There's a lion in the square. Oh, man. Right? So doesn't want to work, doesn't want to engage in life. Whatever responsibilities are forthcoming in this sluggard's life, they don't want to be a part of. Make note of this. So many of us have excuses. I am certainly guilty of it, Ryan, of reasons why I don't want to engage, or I don't want to do work, or I don't want to whatever. And they are all, for the most part, like armpits. We all got them, and they all stink, right? You ever heard that line about excuses? It's the truth.
I've heard other ways of putting that.
Yeah. Stick with armpits. safer. So, it's a mark of a sluggard. Those that are not willing to work hard, take responsibility for their actions, and embrace that. It's one of the key lessons we're trying to teach one of our kids right now, is this idea of accepting responsibility for you, your decisions, your possessions, your friends, how you interact, like in the consequences of those, and the blessings of making good choices. Like that's it's a big concept, and it's a lot to wrap your head around, and it can be difficult. I remember dealing with a college student when I was in college ministry in Denton. Kid was super, super good kid, but man, anything you told him, while he was late, or why he couldn't get this thing done on time, or why he couldn't meet this meeting, because he had this paper he had to write that he's known about for like 6 weeks, but all of a sudden he had to write it today instead of go to this meeting. There was always an excuse. And I remember sitting down and just one of these like father to son like conversations with him. We were friends, and I was a little bit older than him. I said, man, I love you, but every time something comes up, it's always this excuse. Like, buddy, you need to embrace life and responsibility and just do it. And I remember this guy, it was like the first time anybody had told him, like, bro, that's an excuse. Like, you're better than that. You're capable of way more than this. I see it in you, but you keep offering me this door turning on its hinges theology. I don't want to get out of bed and do anything. And man, this kid turned his life around. It was amazing just to see him go, man, I do that. I'm like, wow, dude, you're teachable as well. Like, it was amazing. So think about this. If this is something that marks you with excuses as to why you don't take responsibility for actions, it's the mark of a fool in Scripture. I wrestle with it. More than likely, you wrestle with it. But let's not make it something that marks us as believers. Okay, excuses are exactly what they are. Okay, and we need to figure out how to move past those and engage in life. And so often for me, it is the, I just want to sleep, right? This morning particularly. I was like, I do not want to get out of bed. So, but because I love you guys.
Thank you, Mike.
All for you. No, I just... I knew Aaron would rejoice too much in my absence and just celebrate. So I came just to spite him, actually. Anyway, all right. Let's go to Exodus. We're in a fun piece of this story of Moses. Let me pray for us, and then we will dive back into these tests or difficulties or just kind of big picture things that are getting weighed onto our boy Moses, and we'll kind of see the end results of those this morning. So let me pray. God, as we look at life, and especially as we look at the life through the eyes of Moses, and we watch what you're taking him through, what a phenomenal guy that's got a fuse that's a mile long, a guy that you have chosen to shepherd your people. Lord, I pray that we would see him just with fresh eyes this morning, and Lord, in the things that you're taking him through, that you're intentionally walking him through great difficulty and making him own that, to show him who you are, show the people of God who you are. That you're not just the God of Egypt, you beat those gods, but you're also the God of the desert, and you're the God of the just enough, and you provide for us with our daily needs. You promise to take care of us just like you did the Israelites thousands of years ago. So Lord, as we engage in our daily lives with our daily needs and our concerns and all the things, Father, that tend to preoccupy our thoughts, that make us worry, make us doubt, Lord, all those things, God, would we lean into you? Would we trust you? Would we, Father, just be reminded of Moses and the people of old, God, that you led to a place where they were utterly at the end of all that they could do to sustain themselves and had to lean fully on you. God, would you bring us to those places in our lives graciously? Would you help us to trust you in those moments? Would you comfort us and reassure us that you are indeed there in the midst of our times of difficulty and trouble? God, would we learn again this morning from your word? Would you teach us? In Christ's name. Amen. Man, it's funny. Like, I taught you guys this on, what was that, last Friday? And we were in the middle of a long, boring story that you guys don't care about. Anyway, a house. We're refinancing our house, right? So we're flipping a loan around. Anyway.
What does that mean?
We were going from a 30-year loan to a 15-year loan, trying to be good stewards of our finances, to pay our house off quickly. Anyway, so in the midst of this, I made this really stupid financial decision. In the midst of trying to figure out how to pay for my wife's surgery that's coming up, right? So it was a good decision. I should have delayed it 2 weeks. So in the middle of this big, like, if you guys have ever done a refi or anything, like, they want to know, like, I'm surprised they didn't order a colonoscopy on me. It's those that they want to know everything about you. Everything, right? So at, like, the 11th hour, the loan is supposed to fund, and it doesn't. And I get a call from my lender, and he's like, what did you do? I'm like, oh, gosh, I didn't even think to ask you about...
No,
you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, and he's panicking, and anyway, so I'm laying in bed in the middle of the night, and I'm like, Lord, that was so stupid. All I had to do was wait 2 weeks to make that decision, and you know, it was all, and it's the right decision. I just didn't think about the repercussions of it in the midst of it, and now, like, we're gonna lose our rate and all this stuff. I'm like, oh Lord, and I'm sitting in bed thinking, Mike, there's absolutely nothing you can do about this. It was a mistake. You need to move on. It was still the right decision, but you got to trust God. I can't fix this, right? I cannot do anything about this. I've got to lean into God. And he continues to put me in these situations where, Mike, you just taught this. Now live it, right? You can't just teach it to them and think that you don't get to live it as well, buddy. You're not an exception to that rule. So anyway, he does that to me all the time. So apparently I am not doing a great job of learning this lesson. So all you're about to hear today is for me. Just enjoy the process. So thank you for... but man, it's life, right? We get here. And God is walking through. Again, we're going to see four big tests in Moses' life. And when it's with these people, we're not talking about small things. Water, food, water, and then attack from a group of people by the name of the Amalekites. Like, these are the basic needs of life. Food, shelter, important things, and these are the things that are struggles for the people now that God has got them into the wilderness, right? So we saw them, again, cross the Red Sea, chapter 12 and 13, 15, they sing the song. Miriam, the worship leader, leads the people in the midst of that. Chapter 15, verse 22, they get out of the land, out of the area of the Red Sea, and now they're in what we've called lab, right? We see the first of the four issues there in 15:22 and following, which was this issue of water, right? They're heading south down the Sinai Peninsula. They're out of the land where they had, you know, at least plentiful water. 3 days into this journey, and they're already complaining about water. And God provides water for them. You guys remember how he did it?
He renewed the spring, the water, and the stagnant water.
Yeah. By what means?
Throwing a log into the lake.
Throwing a log into the lake, right? So how does that work? I don't know. But that's what God did, right? So he provides for them miraculously that way. Chapter 16, then, is about the issue of food. How are we going to eat? We're out of all the stuff that we brought out with us. Lord, what do we eat now? And God provides for them what? Manna, right? So, yummy food, but boy, it works. It's sustenance. Mm-hmm. So he's providing for them food. He says, hey, by the way, it's an issue of trust. Every day you get up, you gather what you need for that day. On the Sabbath, you're going to gather 2 days' worth of food. It's the only day that it won't spoil. And I'm going to provide for you for 40 years like this in the wilderness. It's just going to be there waiting for you. And there are no other options. If I don't provide for you, you die. Okay? Chapter 17, now we're going to return to that story. So we're in the midst of these first two tests, and we're going to have now yet another issue about the daily provisions that they need of life. 17:1, let's watch what's going on.
The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded, and they camped in Rephidim.
Yeah, whatever that, Rephaim or something like that.
Oh, okay. But there was no water for the people to drink.
So we're traveling south down the Sinai Peninsula. We are hugging kind of the Gulf of Aqaba. Now we're beginning to head more southeast. So if you look at the Sinai Peninsula like a triangle, they're really actually close to Mount Sinai. So they are in the middle of the worst part of the land. Okay, so this is, they're moving away from any water sources. Now they're in proximity of where Mount Sinai is going to be, where Moses is going to receive the law. Difficult, difficult area. And there is no greater need than this, right? They need water. And they've already dealt with this once, right? The people are getting frustrated. Moses provides for them through the Lord's means. God provides them through Moses is probably a better way to say it. But now they're back where they were just a couple weeks ago, right? Therefore, the people said to Moses, they quarreled with Moses, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? God figured this out before. God will figure this out again. Trust the Lord. Why are you barking at me? Okay, keep going, verse 3.
Why do you put the people... Oh, but the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses, and they said, why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and our livestock die of thirst? And
now, this seems like a bit of an overstatement, right? It sounds dramatic. It sounds like, it's so hard. But think about this. Man, you're a month's journey into the wilderness, and there's no water to drink. Your food is, maybe it comes to you, maybe it doesn't, and it's this white stuff that's laying on the ground. Like, what is that? That's literally what they named it. What is that? What is it? That's what manna means? What is it? What the heck is it? I'm going to eat it. And how are you feeling? This is legit. It's hot, it's miserable, and you don't have water. Like, this is life and death type of stuff. This isn't, oh, my car doesn't have air conditioning, right? These are not luxury items of life. These are not first world problems. These are legit, real issues. And again, boy, seeing this area for the first time with my own eyes, I went, okay, I get it. I am an Israelite. I would have been a grumbler and a complainer with the best of them, right? I'd have been leading the charge on Team Grumble and Complain. So this is hard and this is real, okay? And yet in the midst of it, Moses doesn't have water either, right? It's not like he's got a special analogy from God. He is saying, look, God's going to provide. Trust him. Stop barking, okay? So verse 4, keep going.
Then Moses cried out to the Lord, what am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me.
Now, again, make an observation about verse 4 for me. What have we seen with Moses?
He went to God.
Yep, they grumble to him, he goes to God. Now, verse 4, Moses says, What do you want me to do? Okay, a little more and they will stone me. Does that sound like a bit of a dramatic statement as well? Man, I thought it did. And the more I read it, I think, no, I think it's legit. Like, these people are so mad and so irritated and so concerned that God has brought them into this place just to kill them. Like, why didn't you just kill us in Egypt? That he's afraid he's going to lose his life. Now, remember this based on what we're going to see next chapter out of Moses. He is fearful, I think, for his very life at the level of grumbling and complaining that's happening among the people. This is an ugly, ugly thing, and it's a mark of this entire generation. But he's fearful that they may kill him if he doesn't provide. That's not a great place to be as a leader. That's a little bit scary. And they're all looking at you to fix their problem. Okay?
It's like the congregation trying to tell the pastor, yell at the pastor or something, trying to fix their problem or something.
Yep. Yep, I was just talking to a buddy of mine yesterday that's in a church here in town, and that's the situation. Another buddy of mine I was on the phone with last week, and he's, you know, all the issues, and they need someone to embody the issue, because God is not in flesh and clothing before them, so it needs to be somebody else's fault. We need a scapegoat. you're the guy, right? That's a hard place to be. And to go, Lord, this isn't about me. They're barking at you. I'm just the middleman, right? They're yelling at the messenger. This isn't my fault. I can't fix it. But here we are. So lo and behold, that's the spot Moses is in. And we continue to see him every time. I should say almost every time. We'll get there. He handles this with such poise and tact and dignity and trust in the Lord. That's it's amazing. So verse 5, let's find out how God's going to solve this problem.
Then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock of Hebron, or Herod,
sorry. Or, yeah.
And you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel.
How about that? So what's God's solution?
Go kick the rock.
You're going to take a stick, and you're going to slap a rock, and you're going to get water out of it. Perfectly logical solution, right? Oddly enough, the photos I was showing you guys on last Friday, we saw that kind of the area that had a bit of that stagnant, nasty water in it. That was in the summer. There actually is water flowing out of a rock in that area. So a spring comes through a rock that's up in kind of like a waterfall area. So some people suggested maybe that's where it was. It seems to be way, way too far north. But it's not odd that water would come from a rock. So maybe God used something that was natural and turned it into something that was supernatural, but he provides a spring that comes out of a rock, a fresh spring in the desert. And these are all over, I shouldn't say all over, they're present in Israel. There's places like this, little oases in the desert where water can be found in plenty if you know where to look. So this is God's solution. He doesn't do it the same way he did before. Last time was throw this log into the water. This time it's hit this rock with a stick and you're going to get water. Why, by the way, would God do things differently, not provide water the same way? Yeah, let's go back to what works. Let's rub our lucky magic's foot, right? If I just throw a log into the water, it works every time. What do I not need? I don't need God. I need a stick. I need, whatever it may be. So God is showing them, look, I'm going to provide, but I'm going to do it my way and my timetable, okay? So God provides water. Notice what he says here in verse 5, pass before all the people with some of your elders. What's God doing there? Who are these elders? We're going to see more on them later. Yeah, so these are probably, well, not probably, they are. They're the heads of the households of these tribes. They're godly, what we know of, as godly as this generation can be, men that are leaders of household, respected individuals amongst the community.
Was Aaron one of them? Or?
Aaron was named before this, so he was maybe, he's certainly a respected guy, but he's, aside from these, there were probably 70 other elders that are going to lead with Moses. What's God showing Moses in the midst of this, by the way? Yeah, community, sharing the leadership burden a little bit. There's a whole lot of you, or a whole lot of them and not a lot of you, so keep that in the back of your mind as well, okay? So he makes them, before he can do this miracle, he makes them get the elders out to lead alongside of him, okay? So strikes the rock at Horeb, provides water. Verse 7, so let me keep pick up there.
And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, is the Lord among us or not?
Anybody got a note on what those words mean? Massah?
Testing
and quarreling. Like, that's not a good, like, Ebenezer, right? Rock pile of remembrance that you want to have named after you. Like, yeah, you want to see if God's here or not, if God's going to show up, is the Lord among us or not? We're going to name this place Bickering and Complaining. That's not good, right? You're getting an indication of what's inside of these people, the lack of trust in them. Again, they have just seen 11 ridiculous miracles, 10 plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea. And yet this is the attitude, the heart of these folks. Now, again, they're dealing with very difficult stuff. So to be fair, I don't know that I would handle this any differently, but these are real life situations. So God has been put on the test twice with the issue of water, once on food. Looks like he's passing with flying colors so far. He's yet to fail his people. And now in verse 8 and following, we're going to see something completely different. Okay, another issue that's going to lead to the culmination of all of this difficulty. Okay, 17:8, somebody pick up there.
Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand.
Okay, so Amalek, or the Amalekites, or the group of people, come out and fight Israel while they're in the wilderness, okay? So territorial, we don't know what provoked this per se, but they come and attack Israel. They are the instigators of this attack, okay? So God says, hey, I want you to get, or Moses says, I want Joshua. This is the first we've heard of this guy. This is the same Joshua of the book of Joshua, who's going to be Moses' successor. When Moses dies and doesn't get to go into the promised land, Joshua's the guy that's going to take the baton and lead the nation in. Okay, so God the young man, we're seeing snippets of that already. And he goes to lead the people. And Moses says, what am I going to do? What's Moses' role in verse 9? I'm going to go up on a hill with the staff of God in my hand. Okay, verse 10, keep rolling.
So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill.
What's the imagery there? What are Moses, Aaron, and Hur doing on the top of the hill while Joshua was down below leading the people? It looks like he's up there praying. Okay, that's the idea. So behind the scenes, as Joshua was leading the people in battle, Moses and Aaron and Hur are up praying. They're praying that God would prevail, okay? It's a really cool picture of the power of prayer, kind of what's happening behind the scenes. Verse 11 and 12, keep rolling.
Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him. And he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun.
So literally, it's this picture when Moses is coming to God, weary, in prayer, and he's able to lift up his hands, the nation of Israel prevails. When he's tired and weary and can't sustain himself, Israel's losing the battle. So literally, he just propped his hands up with stones, right? But we use this, I remember as we would, in our college ministry days, go out and share the gospel. We were some of those, as PJ was maybe mentioning earlier this week, if you heard him teach, going door to door, knocking on doors, and coming to visitors of our church that had left info cards or whatever, and we'd share the gospel with them. It was a means of doing what we were doing. But before we would ever go out, we would meet in groups of three, according to this text, and we would pray and say, Lord, this battle's not ours, it's yours. So we're going to go, and we're going to talk to these people about the Lord and share the gospel with them. And behind the scenes, we were memorizing an outline and all this stuff, exactly what PJ had done as well, of how to share and communicate the gospel to people. It was absolutely nerve-wracking. You wet your pants and knock on the door and say, here we go. But we realized, Lord, this is your battle. This is a spiritual thing. So this has been a cool text to kind of indicate, you know, that the prayer is really the thing that's causing the victory. It's not Joshua and his wits and his might or the ability of the Israelites to fight. At the end of the day, it's these godly individuals that are praying on behalf of the Lord, on behalf of the people to the Lord, that they would win this battle. Okay, so it's a neat picture. But you're seeing something in Joshua, by the way. What type of leader is he? What's the first position we see in him? He's a military guy. He's a battle guy. Man, Joshua's a bulldog. He's going to lead very differently than Moses, which is good, because to try to fill Moses' shoes would have been quite difficult. But he's going to lead different. So when we need a guy that's going to come into the land and conquer and remove people groups and take over the land that is God's, Joshua's going to be the guy. He's the fit for this.
He was a savage.
It certainly seems that way. He does not screw around. So we'll see more of his personalities. We journey, obviously, into the book of Joshua. But this is the guy. So just take note of some of the things you see him. He is a godly, younger man that's already trusted in the midst of the assembly of the people. We know he's over 40 at this point. So we'll show you that later. So he's a guy that's my age-ish, right? And Moses is 80-plus at this point and leading his people out, okay? So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. And then watch in verse 14. This is a really, really strong statement. Listen to what God says about this group of people.
Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek.
Wow. What did God just say about this people group?
They're done.
We are going to wipe them off the face of the earth. I'm sorry. So, like, I get it. These group of people attacked the Israelites on their journey. Why would God's response be this strong? Okay.
I gather he's not a pacifist.
No, not so much. That's weird, isn't it? Turn to Deuteronomy 25 real quick, and I'll show you why. So Deuteronomy, by the way, just to give you a quick orientation, is the second Exodus and Leviticus, right? We're going to kill off a generation in the desert, as you guys know, that's disobedient, and then we're going to have a new generation. And all this stuff that God's going to tell this generation with the giving of the law that we're going to get to today, he's got to retell to the new generation that didn't hear it, that they were too young, right? They were the baby Bjorns being carried by their mamas around in the desert, and they didn't get to hear it, so it's a second doing of the law. Chapter 25, verses 17 through 19, tells us in a little bit more detail about the Amalekites and what they did, okay? Verse 17, remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt, okay? Same story. He's telling Joshua and the group, and really Moses at this point, to remember that. How he met you along the way, in verse 18, and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary and did not fear God. So how do the Amalekites start this attack? The stragglers at the rear. Who more than likely would have been the stragglers at the rear?
Women and children.
Women and children. You dirty dog. That ain't right. Like, if you're going to fight, at least fight with the able-bodied men that would have been able to lead, or hopefully in that day even too, the strong women that were able to lead, but in this time probably the men. So the women who are carrying children, young kids, babies, this is who they attack. That's dirty. And God says, we are going to wipe them off the face of the earth. By the way, who's the guy that's going to be issued this order to fulfill this prophecy? Anybody know? It's Saul, oddly enough. With David, Saul, that generation, God says this is going to happen. And for whatever reason, he says the iniquity of the Amalekite is not complete. And he says, in this day, when Saul was ruling in his 40 years of reign as the first king of Israel, God says, this promise that I promised Moses about this group of people, you are going to be the instrument. I have given them grace to live for another 400 years, and now we're going to eradicate this generation. We'll see that in 1 Samuel chapter 15, by the way. So this was the Amalekites' attack on the Israelites, and this is what God, why he would respond so strongly. They took out, the women and children. They said, we are going to utterly blot out your name from heaven. We're not even going to give you a memorial. We're going to erase your name from the record books. You guys are done. So, dirty, okay? So, issue of water at Meribah, God provides through the throwing of a log into water. Issue of food, God provides through manna. Water again at Rephaim. And now we're going to see the attack on the Amalekites. So Moses has gone through what you would look at, kind of four leadership crises, four deals where you were, man, you're at the end of kind of your emotional, spiritual energy. Like, you're pretty toast at this point. You've come off the mountaintops, you've seen God provide, but this is exhausting. So I just want you to think about the physical condition of Moses at this point, right? That's kind of where we're at. Joseph, do you have a thought or question?
Do we have any history on the Amaleks in that, like, what their societal history was? Like, you said, gave grace and stuff. Like, were they just like a consistent gnat to the Israelites?
They're enemies of Israel for sure. Past that, I don't know a ton. So we'll see them pop up here and there, but no, it's
there's no history or like what they're known for, their culture, why they fought.
We'll see them a little bit in Deuteronomy. They're just unfriendly towards Israel. Territorial and afraid of them. So, but no, I don't know a ton about there. Not like like the Ninevites or anything like that, or some of the Assyrians, some of the stuff that we see in Jonah. I don't have a ton of background. So, just dirty. Okay. So,
you can't look them up anymore.
They're gone. Can't even Wikipedia them. Who are the Amalekites?
Who?
So, four significant crises, if you will, for Moses. And 18 is going to be Moses' happy place. Okay. He is going to get a brief respite in the midst of difficulty. Moses has nobody, by the way, in a sense, that he can share this with, who can share safely with. He can't go bark at his people. Maybe Aaron and Miriam would have been a sounding board for him, but as a whole, he is kind of isolated. So 18, 1 and following, I want you to keep this in mind as we're kind of journeying through the story. I think really God gives Moses this season because he needs it. He is... he's on the ragged edge, if you will. 18:1, let's pick up there.
had gotten it down for Moses and for Israel and his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt.
Now think about that. I mean, they're in Egypt. Where's Jethro? Where do they live? In Midian, right? This is far away. And the story of what God's doing is spreading. And you're gonna realize as we read this story, everybody is hearing about what God is doing on behalf of his people. And they're literally fearful of this God because of his provision for his people. Okay, so this tall tale, this Paul Bunyan story, if you will, is spreading. But it's real. God is really doing this. So the people are hearing about it. Keep rolling into it. So here's some of the, sorry, not to cut you off, Katie. Some of the speculation of, man, does sent away mean like sent her home? Sent her away meaning issued her divorce papers? She's very clearly described as his wife here and a couple other times in this text. So whether they're still married or not, he's going to take another wife soon, by the way, Moses will. So it looks to be this is the last interaction that we're going to have with them. And she's not even the, like, she's there, but kind of, and Moses, his kids for that matter, are kind of on the side stage. The main interaction is between Moses and Jethro that we're about to see. So keep rolling.
And her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, for Moses said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. The other was named Eliezer, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh.
So Jethro's going to show up, meet Moses, with his wife and his two kids. Okay? Jethro, Moses' father-in-law came in, verse 5, with his sons, with his wife, to Moses in the wilderness where he was camped at the Mount of God. So they are now at Mount Sinai. Okay, they're at the foot of Mount Sinai. We saw it last chapter, by the way, at Horeb. Horeb and Mount Sinai are the same place, just different names. So they are at the place where they are going to spend now about a year camped at the base of this mountain. So much of what's about to occur in the reading that we're going to take place in is at Mount Sinai. Just to give you guys a boundary marker, from Exodus chapter here, really, or basically 19, all the way to Numbers chapter 11, we are parked at the base of Mount Sinai. Okay? They never move. And then God's going to lead them through the wilderness again. So we've taken this journey down to the peninsula. They take a long pause to get there. God's going to give them the law, the commandments, the instructions on building the tabernacle, and talk through a ton of history. And it's not till Numbers chapter 11 when God's going to say, okay, we're going to now move again, and we're going to head up to get into the promised land. We'll see that journey, but they are here for a long time, okay? So, here Jethro comes in, and they're going to meet. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, verse 7. He bowed down, and he kissed him, and they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. So, here's a guy that really is Moses' kind of adopted father. He doesn't have a dad, per se. This is a guy that we know that he loves and trusts. Verse 8, watch this conversation that they have.
Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had befallen them on the journey, and how the Lord had delivered them.
What do you think that conversation looked like? What is he telling Jethro?
Crazy.
Yeah, I mean, first of all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake. I mean, can you imagine walking through the plagues, and then I did this, and then God did that, and then he sent me here, and then he made me talk to Pharaoh, and then this came, and then frogs, and then gnats, and then holy cow, we were safe, and then Israel. I mean, you can just imagine just him expounding on the awesomeness of God, and like the culmination with the Passover and that process, and Jethro just sitting there mesmerized about what God had systematically done to get Israel out of Egypt. That had to be amazing. So it's cool that he starts there. He starts with, let me tell you, Jethro, what my God has done, and really what our God has done. You're going to see Jethro is very much a guy that identifies with the Lord, okay? So he starts with that, and then where does he go? Also, the hardship that had befallen them on the journey and how the Lord had delivered them. What is that?
Talking about how they ran out of water.
That's the last few chapters that we just read. Yeah, we got out of the wilderness, and now, you know, we're out of Egypt. We went into the wilderness, and all of a sudden we don't have water, and then we don't have food, and then we don't have water again, and then we get attacked by the Amalekites. Like, he's like, man, and here's the people, and they are griping at me, and man, Jethro, honestly, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it tomorrow. I'm not sure if I'm going to get, like, strangled in my sleep tonight by some frustrated guy that, you know, can't, like, I think they may stone me, right? This is emotional, like, He's finally got somebody safe to communicate with. Of like, man, this is hard. Like, I don't like this. I don't like the spotlight. And you're going to see that By the way, several times, Moses doesn't yearn for this. This isn't, again, we saw that in, as God called him, the four excuses of Moses, like, please go pick somebody else. That's the same attitude that he has in here. Like, I'll do the job, but, man, I'm not yearning for my name to be in the paper. Look who delivered Israel. You know, that's not, he's not some politician grandstanding for an opportunity. He's just doing his job, and he's doing it well. But, man, I think he's just unloading, if you will, to Jethro, who's there to listen, and that's kind of been his role his whole life, okay? But he finishes, verse 8, how?
The Lord delivered them.
Yeah, but you know what? Even in the midst of that, Jethro, God showed up. Man, it's been hard, but God has shown himself faithful and good to us, so it had to be just a cool recounting of that story, okay? Jethro rejoiced, verse 9, over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. Verse 10, read this.
Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people.
Man, what does that sound like? Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods. What gods would Jethro be speaking of?
The Egyptian gods.
Potentially there, as well as his own, gods of Midian, right? The Midianite gods. Your God is greater than my gods. What does that sound like? It's a conversion statement, right? Like, holy cow. So, yeah, Moses, if you need to go, and all right, you've been a great shepherd for 40 years, but man, if you're saying that this God's calling you to go to Egypt to go deliver some people, yeah. Man, okay. And now he's coming back to him reporting on what God's done. This is phenomenal. So it almost seems like the way the text reads that this is a moment where the lights are coming on from Jethro. Of like, yeah, I know you're God, but I don't know you're God. And in this moment, it almost seems like, man, he's legit. So I think Jethro's a believer. We're going to hang out and party with this guy in heaven. And he knows the Lord. And he's making a statement about the awesomeness of the God that Moses serves. And now it seems like he serves as well. Keep rolling there in verse 12. I'm sorry, verse... did we finish 12? Yeah. And 11. And then now 12.
Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law.
So they enjoy a meal together with the people. 13. Now watch this.
It came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. And the people stood about Moses from the morning until the evening.
So what's Moses doing? What does that mean? He's standing before the people and judging them. I don't like your sweater. Those are ugly shoes. What does it mean to judge?
Is it like the teaching and admonishing? Sorry, if anyone had their hand up.
Providing counsel.
Yeah, it's counsel. What type of counsel would you guess he's providing?
Bless you.
1.5 to 3 million people. What do you think is going on in the desert? If they're bickering at Moses, you think they're bickering at one another?
Yeah, probably.
Well, I had this Calphalon pan, and then so-and-so took it, and now it's mine, and I found it in their stuff. And Moses, what are you going to do about that? You know, like, you just imagine all these interpersonal, right, stuff that they're trying to figure out. Some of them may have been legit, but most of this is probably he's solving problems for the people. Okay, so he's the guy. There's a gazillion of them, and everything ends in a pyramid at the top, and Moses. And if you have a problem that needs to get solved, you go to Moses. So you can imagine how long that line is, right? Now, what's Jethro doing? Verse 14.
What is this thing that are you doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge and all the people stand about you from morning until evening?
So what's Jethro's role in his community, by the way? Yeah, he's an older leader, established guy. He's the leader of the Midian. He's a priest of Midian, as he's described to us. So he's a guy that shares this, like, yeah, I know what this feels like. Maybe not a million people, but I lead a community. And he says, man, Moses, what are you doing? Why do you alone sit and judge the people? What you are doing, why do you alone sit from morning until evening? So this was literally an all-day affair. Moses' answer, verse 15.
Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor and make known the statutes of God and his laws.
Doesn't that sound noble and godly? Because the people come to me, I have a desire to serve them, and then I open up my Bible and I tell them what God's heart is. I'm just doing what God's asked me to do. Like, that sounds noble and good. Listen to Jethro's response to this.
Moses' father-in-law said to him, the thing that you are doing is not good.
Wow. What you're doing is not good. This is not good. What does Moses think this is? I'm trying to be helpful. I'm trying to be beneficial. I'm trying to solve problems and to create harmony where there's a lack thereof. And Jethro says, this is bad. This is not good. It's fascinating, this observation. Watch what he's pushing on with Moses.
You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone.
Make some observations about verse 18. Why is what Moses is doing not good? It's not sustainable, right? What's going to happen to Moses?
He won't be able to lead.
You will surely wear out. What is that called? What do we call that in today? Yeah, it's you're going to burn out, bro. Boy, you're red hot on fire right now, but man, you're a couple months into this. What do you think is going to happen in a year or 2 years? Or by the way, 40 years in the desert of him doing this. That he's going to go in one day, just beat his head on the wall one more time and say, you know what, I'm done. I'm packing up my bags. I'm going back to Midian. I mean, I'm going to go shepherd sheep. They don't talk back to me. Yeah, I need a shovel and I got to clean up poop, but that sounds way better than dealing with these barking people. That right? It's not just that. What else? You surely will wear out. And you're going to wear your people out. They can't handle this. That line is a mile long for them to try to get in here and talk to you. So what you think is helpful, Moses, is actually the opposite. And the way this is going to end, when you fast forward, is you're going to be burnt out. And these people are going to be extremely frustrated, and they're going to get worn out. You're going to create the exact thing within them that you're trying to avoid. Bitterness, frustration, more strife. This is a horrible, horrible system. This is a leadership problem. Moses doesn't know how to lead. He's good with sheep, right? Because there's one of him and some sheep, and he can handle his flock. Problem is what happened to his flock. It multiplied exponentially, and now Moses has to figure out how to lead. And it's Jethro, the Midianite, who's going to say, bro, listen to me. You need to change how you're leading, okay? Verse 19.
Now listen to me. I will give you counsel and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. Then teach them the statutes and the laws and make known to them the way in which they are to live and the work they are to do. Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able, men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. Let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you.
What's Jethro's advice?
Bro,
you got to get some help. And you got to structure this thing in a way where you're not the linchpin in all this. You're going to set groups of godly men over the people. And you're going to organize them in groups of 10, groups of 50. Right? This guy's over these 10. And above him is this guy who oversees these five guys. Total that are over 50, right? It's a structure. He's putting in checks and balances in the system. You need to share the burden with other godly people. There are godly men, Moses, that are capable, that have leadership savvy and chops to do this. You need to trust them. You need to lean into them. You can't do this alone. And let them solve the lower level issues. And if they hit some harder issues that they need help with, then you show up. Then you speak into that. But it's gone through the 10, and then the leader of the 50, and then the leader of the hundreds and the thousands, and then it's gone up to you when they're stuck. You're the Supreme Court, right? Let the other people handle the lower level stuff that can be handled at their level, let them solve those problems. So you don't need to hear about Aunt Sophie's cat that ran into someone's tree, and they can take care of that. But you do need to hear about these big issues that they're having trouble solving. So the answer ultimately to this is what? You've got to share the leadership burden. You need a team. You're going to wear out if you don't do this on your own. You guys remember Acts chapter 6 as you guys were rolling through that? It's right before the stoning of Stephen. The church is in a very pivotal time. They're struggling with the daily needs of the church. And then you've got Peter and the boys that are serving tables and taking care of widows and trying to preach the word. What do they end up doing in that situation? They appoint leaders. Man, we need deacons. We need godly men who can do what only they can do so that we can attend ourselves to what? Teaching the word in prayer. Like, there's a couple things that we do well, and we need to do those. And there's a lot of things that we don't do well, but there's other godly people who do them really well. Share the burden. Give them that. This isn't just an Old Testament context. It's a New Testament concept as well. And Moses is learning this lesson, thankfully, early on in the journey before he completely burns out. Jethro gives him some of the most godly, practical advice that he could have received, and this is exactly what he needed to hear. Gang, remember that as you lead in the ministry situations that you guys are in, okay? You guys are all gifted individuals. At the end of the day, you can't do it all. And you need to embrace that and recognize that. There are a couple things that God has probably gifted you with that you do well. Some of you are stupid talented, and that God has blessed you with the ability to do a ton of things well, okay? Figure out what that is. You need to know yourself, you need to know your strengths, and you also need to know your weaknesses. And you've got to surround yourself with people that are strong where you're weak. That takes admitting, I'm not good at this, and I need to bring in people, if you will, to hold up my arms, because I don't do this well. And I need to delegate that to them and let them do it. At the end of the day, I have two, arguably, spiritual gifts, maybe one. I know through experience and practice and joy and those things what I do well, and there's other things in the midst of the church that I don't do well. I'm terrible at. And I watch other people not just excel, but enjoy. So remember that as you guys lead. You need team. You need help. There is nothing more frustrating when you're a lower level leader trying to grow through the ranks and find places where you can put your gifts on display or exercise those gifts in a godly way, and there's somebody at the top that's trying to control it all, and you don't have the ability to do that. There's nothing more maddening. Okay, one of the greatest things you guys can do as a leader is be secure in your leadership and exalt others and give them opportunities and promote them. Don't be intimidated by great leaders around you. Again, this is Pharaoh, the guy with Joseph. This is why I love this guy. He's like, man, I don't know how to organize a country like this. I don't know how to handle the administrative load of dividing food for 7 years and storing it and then administering it to the world. I can't do that, but you can. This is Joseph, everybody. Welcome, say hi. He's going to be the guy for the next 14 years around here. Everybody cool with that? Fantastic. He just exalted him. So you guys are going to be in positions where you can do that for others. And if you've ever had somebody do that for you, that's opened a door for you or given you an opportunity, maybe that you weren't quite ready for, but trusted you and believed in you, man, it is an awesome, awesome thing. Okay, so Jethro is giving this guy spot on solid advice. Okay, so as you guys think through the ministries or just the jobs that you're going to have, the people that you're going to lead in your positions, whether it's in the church or outside the church, this is a phenomenal lesson to be learned, okay? Now, thankfully, verse 24, Moses is humble enough to do this.
So Moses listened to his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. They judged the people at all times, the difficult dispute they would bring to Moses, but every minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went.
Isn't that cool? It's like God divinely appointed this meeting to solve this problem for Moses. The biggest issue in his life was this. If you keep leading like this, Moses, you're going to implode. You're not going to make it 40 years. You're not going to make it 40 days, bro. This ain't going to work. So, beautiful picture. And again, we don't hear more of his wife, or his kids we do, but his wife we don't hear any more of. It seems like they all go back with Jethro for whatever reason, and they go back home to Midian. Now, Moses is going to continue to lead his people through the wilderness. Okay? So, four, what I would call kind of crises of leadership, solved by Jethro at the end of it. I think you're seeing at the end of this, by the way, a worn out, tired, exhausted emotionally Moses. And I think this guy just poured life into him. So Jethro's a neat dude. And just another great nugget as well. I mean, you guys need Jethro's in your life, and you're going to have the opportunity to be Jethro's to other people, to speak life into people's life, to encourage them. To build them up, to tell them what they're good at and what they're also not good at. And Jethro wasn't afraid to say, bro, I love you, but this is not good leadership. You need to change. And Moses is godly enough to go, man, I need to own that. Dang it. Like, I haven't done that well, and I didn't see that. I'm blindsided by that. Thank you, right? So this is just a cool picture of and how that can be done well, all right? Now, chapter 19, we're going to make a shift. Okay, we have been in the first few chapters, all the way through chapter 12. We were kind of in Israel's subjection in Egypt. This last section from coming out of the Red Sea in 12 and following up to 18, we've been seeing God kind of using the people in the midst of the wilderness in these trials. 19 now, we're going to begin our time parked at the foot of Mount Sinai. And now we're going to see the giving of the law, the Mosaic law. We're going to see now God deliver to his people. And this is a beautiful section of Scripture. Okay, so let's pick up 19:1 and let's get into now the Mosaic law.
In the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai.
All right, so they've been 3 months from leaving Egypt, and now they're there. Okay, and again, they're going to sit here for 1 year. It's taken them 3 months to get here. Okay, keep rolling.
When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. And there Israel camped in front of the mountain.
Okay, again, there's several in this area. We don't know which one they are. Some of these are 8,000 feet in elevation. There's a few that are mentioned. We don't know where. There's 20-plus locations that could be it. So it seems like the kind of the bottom center of the Sinai Peninsula that I've showed you guys before seems to be probably the best place. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Okay, so there's a Mount Sinai somewhere, and it's real. Verse 3.
Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel."
Let's tear that apart a little bit. This is cool.
Yeah.
He says, man, I want you to remember, first of all, verse 3. You go tell the house of Jacob and the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians. You watched me wreck shop. I took care of that nation. I won the battles. I did everything. And you left like you had just conquered an army. And not only that, but how have I cared for you in verse 4? I bore you on eagles' wings and brought you to myself. So not only was I the God that wins battles, but I'm also the mother hen. I've cared for you guys. I've protected you guys in the wilderness. I've taken care of your needs. There's some interesting imagery, by the way, I've heard with eagle's wings as to how baby eagles learn how to fly. Have you guys heard this story before? The mother eagle, I'm told, you guys can go snoops this thing and find out if it's true, pushes the babies out of the nest and they learn how to fly on the way down. And she swoops them up, like, on eagle's wings if they have problems. She's there to support them. So they don't hit the ground, but that's how you learn to swim. You get thrown in the pool. Good luck. Drowning or swimming? Oh, swimming. Okay, good. Drowning. Okay, then I jump in, right? That's how you learn. It's trial by fire. So, yeah, did I put you in difficulty? Absolutely. Was I there the whole time? Absolutely. You were never going to fail. You're never, you know, for those of you that have taught kids to swim, it's that same picture. Like, you know, you're taking them underwater, like, they can't breathe. And they're looking through these eyes like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm here. You're okay. Trust me. But they don't get it. I mean, it is just full-on panic in their eyes when they're, you know, the first time they're underwater. But they get it. Like, God built this thing into them where they know not to breathe. They hold their breath, and it's miraculous. But you're there as a parent thinking, I'm drowning my child right now. Like, this is horrible. And I'm paying somebody for the ability to do this. I'm like, what is going on? So God says, man, I've taken care of you. Okay, verse 5. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples. Literally, my special treasure, for all the earth is mine. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. What is God saying about his relationship with Israel? What does it mean that they will be his own possession amongst the peoples? Yeah, you're chosen. I've selected you. And we're going to see that language over and over with Israel, right? You're about to go into a land where there's a gazillion different ites. None of those ites are mine. You're mine. You're my own people, my special treasure. It's like God's pet name for Israel. It's like sweetheart or honey or whatever. That's how he addresses his nation. He loves them that way. What does it mean that they're going to be a kingdom of priests? What's the priest's job in Israel?
Teach the word of God.
Okay, teach the word of God. They take the people and they take God and they mediate between the people. They take the people and introduce them to God. Hey, people, this is God. This is what God expects of you. God, meet the people, right? Y'all should hang out. But it's the priest's job to mediate in between them, to introduce them to God. If you're going to be a kingdom of priests, what is he saying about Israel? What are you going to do with the other nations? You're going to introduce them to me. You're going to stand in between. You're going to be the people that say, hey, other nations, we serve a rad God, and you should meet him. He's awesome. He's powerful. We want you to know him. Okay, I'm not going to stick you like in Siberia and put a fence around you, and you're not telling me, like, you're going to be interacting with the peoples of the world. That's your job. So, but you're going to be my own special treasure in the midst of that. You are mine.
Would it also be interpreted that maybe these people weren't like directly willing to go out and evangelize, but through their story, through their people's trials, problems, whatever, like that we get introduced to God? Not that we needed to go through this, but that they went through it, we observed it, and then we get to understand God more.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, they're going to be reluctant to do a lot of that, but God's going to put them in situations where they have to. But it's a great example of ultimately, how does God describe the church, by the way? We're a kingdom of priests, right? We're the same way. Second Peter, First Peter, one of the Peters, talks about that. about the role of the church. Priesthood of believers, sorry, that's the language I'm looking for. It's the same idea. So yeah, we all go through that, and God puts us in that situation. But that's the expectation. Like, people don't know the God of the Bible unless there's people there to introduce them. So what do you notice, by the way, that's different about this? We're entering into this covenant language, by the way. That's different about maybe the Abrahamic covenant that we've seen, or even the Edenic, or some of the previous covenants that we've seen in Scripture. What's different about this one?
The other one was like only God doing it, and this one says it.
Very good. If you do these things, then this is not a unilateral covenant. It isn't a one-way agreement. Now, they're still in that relationship with God. That is true. But God's saying now, hey, we're going to form another level of this relationship, if you will. And if you'll obey me, if you'll do these things, then you're going to be a blessed people. And I will rain down on you blessings. And we'll see that all through the book of Deuteronomy, the promises of the law. Okay? However, if you disobey me and you walk in disobedience, then this is going to be that relationship as well. Right? This is a great parent. I love my kids unconditionally. There's nothing that they can do to not be my kid anymore. Right? I love them. They're in covenant relationship with me because of who they are, and I've chosen them. Right? However, do I have expectations and rules with my kids? Yeah. Madison, Callie, Ella, if you do these things, man, we are going to live in peace and harmony together. If you trust me, if you obey my voice, if you listen to my rules that I am setting up for you and your benefit, and you do these things, man, we're going to have a great relationship. However, if you want to walk outside my will and my counsel and do things that are going to be destructive and harmful and hurtful for you, then we're going to have to handle this differently. And at the end of the day, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. I love you, but there are going to be blessings to good decisions, and there are going to be consequences and pain to poor decisions. And because I'm a loving father, I'm going to let you feel both, right? And that's exactly what God's doing. He's parenting his kids.
The kind of the covenant the church is under, the new law what Christ brought. I was going to say, how is that covenant like? Obviously, you can see the different covenants and be like, hey, that's a one-way covenant. This is a two-way covenant. How is that covenant displayed? Is that a one-way or a two-way, would you say?
I don't know that I would use... Well, yeah. I mean, we certainly see Jesus talk about the idea of the cup of the new covenant. So, in that sense, I would look at salvation as a one-way covenant. Mm-hmm. I think it's different in this regard in that... They can break this covenant in a sense by disobedience. I'm breaking the covenant, but jacking up the nature of it. We don't break that covenant with God. In that way, we have no salvation sense. We have no way to break that. Now, we can feel the pain and the consequences of poor decisions within the midst of that covenant relationship with God, mm-hmm. the same way they will. So in that, it's...
So is the... sorry if I'm going off topic. So is the lie... I'll ask you this question after.
Okay. Let's talk about that for a second, okay? We're about to get introduced to the law, right? So we're about to, in Exodus 20, you're going to get we're going to get the Ten Commandments. So we're going to get the Cliff Notes version of all 613 commandments, okay? Exodus, we're going to get them. Deuteronomy, we're going to get a review. So they're about to get all of these laws given to them. Okay, 19 is kind of like the preamble to that. This is like the beginning of a formal document that would be signed, and God is introducing this concept to them. But why the law? Why is God about to do that with them? He's already in covenant relationship with them, so why is he now giving them these 613 commandments? Let me give you guys a couple ideas of maybe why God is doing this, or what the law, the purpose of the law serves. Okay, so I would say first, it's there to expose sin. What do I mean by that? Absolutely, right? If I'm rolling down Shepherd to the residency and I'm going 75 miles an hour and there's no speed limit sign, I don't know what the speed limit is. I don't know if I'm speeding or not, right? But as soon as that sign's up there that says 45 miles an hour, and I'm driving 75 miles an hour, I was, oh gosh, like I'm over the limit here. I'm speeding. So part of the law was to say, hey, this is right. This is wrong. There's certainly that Romans 1 natural law within us that we have that idea of righteousness that's kind of built into us of what's right and what's wrong. But the details of the law, part of it was to expose sin and just to show the people this is sin and this is not, okay? Romans 7:7 talks about that. Paul talks about that in his argument. Like, prior to the law, I did not know I was in violation of the law, and then God showed me the law. So you realize, man, there's times that I'm in violation of the law, okay? Secondly, it's there to protect Israel. Okay? There's things that they can eat. There's things that they can't eat. There's levels of cleanliness that are demanded by God in their households, right? Part of the whole idea of unleavened bread was cleaning out your homes. There's dietary laws. There's ceremonial laws. And a lot of these laws would protect Israel from disease, those sorts of things. There was a rumor back in the days in Europe with the bubonic plague that the Jews started it because it amazingly didn't affect them. And part of the issue with ultimately the plague that was going on in those days was because it had to deal with filth and dirtiness, because Israelites are a clean people, because their law demands that they're a clean people. They were, as not as a whole, but for the most part, unaffected by the plagues. Because, or that one specifically, because they were a clean people. So there's literally built into the law this idea of God protecting them through the decisions that they're going to make. Okay. Thirdly, and this is fascinating to me, it teaches true righteousness. What do I mean by that? If you're in covenant relationship with God, you're guaranteed that according to the Abrahamic covenant. What is then true righteousness? Does true righteousness mean I can do whatever the heck I want to because I'm a child? Yes, God says yes, okay? What does Paul say about that in Romans 6? What's the idea of someone who's a child of God? What shall I say then? Shall I continue to sin?
Certainly
may that grace may increase. And he says it just like that, right? Certainly not. Meganoita. It's the strongest language. I mean, Shay's taught you guys this. Yes, are you in Romans yet?
No.
No. You get there. It's the idea that, hey, just because you're under covenant relationship with God doesn't mean you get to live like a crazy nut job just because you're covered by grace, which you are. But true righteousness is walking with your parents, obeying them and living with them. So part of the relationship expectations with God was that, hey, you're going to obey me. And that's a demonstration of your faith and your obedience in me. I was talking to a guy yesterday. He's a pastor here in town. And we were he was talking about a buddy of his who's a believer. And yet he fully subscribes to this idea of, man, the more you sin, the more grace there is. So like in the language department, man, there are no off-limit words. None. He said, the guy prayed for me. He's like, it was the craziest prayer ever. He's like, man, you were the best effing pastor I've ever seen. And he's like, how do I, like, he's like, oh my gosh, dude, thank you. But no, like, you can't do that. And this guy just has no problem with it. And the idea is, his argument is, man, I'm under grace. Like, man, I'm a child. I can do whatever I want. Like, no, that's not the purpose of the law. Obey and walk with me and demonstrate your righteousness because you're pointing to God. So part of this was ultimately to say, man, as a child, there are expectations that we walk with God in a way that honors him, right? And Paul describes that as well, okay? Now, ultimately, I think one of the things the law does in conclusion, is it points Jesus. 613 laws. I had it broken down further than that. There's I think it's like 248, like, do these things, obey your father and mother, and then 613 by 740, whatever that is. Don't do these things, right? You've got a ton of laws. What do you realize when you're trying to follow 613 laws every day? Man, I can't do this. So what do we have to do? All right, now we've got to have a book of Leviticus. We've got to set up a system where when I break a law, I offer a sacrifice in violation of the law. Every time I do this, and there's like five different types of sacrifices depending on which law I broke and how I broke it. Did I intentionally break it? Like, was I premeditating this? Or was it accidental? And there's a different sacrifice for that. And then once a year at the Day of Atonement, we're going to like get a get-out-of-jail-free card for another year where God's going to predictively realize how much is going to occur in this next year. We're going to pay for those sins and then keep this process going year in and year out all the time. And the book of Hebrews is like, oh, can't we just have one sacrifice for all time that would put an end to this entire system? Like, man, wouldn't that be great? Well, that's part of what God is teaching the Israelites. Like, yes, this is an exhausting system, and it never ends. And you need someone who can obey the law on your behalf that is truly righteous and do this for you, because you can't do it. So ultimately, it's going to show the people, man, as hard as I try, I don't have the ability to follow the law. And frankly, a lot of times, I don't want to, right? It's exposing sin within them to show them, bro, you need a Savior. You need a new heart. You need a new covenant. We need to work on your heart. This was never meant to save Israel. This wasn't their salvation. This wasn't God's plan to say, hey, just obey all these laws and you'll be good. You'll be a right people, right? That's totally contradictory to the God of the New Testament that we know. So he's giving this law for a reason, but it's never intended to be their means of salvation. And the problem is, that's the Jews' hope. The people today, they think, man, if we obey, then God will grant us relationship.
So, like, in the Old Testament, when they looked forward to the Messiah, they didn't see him. They didn't think that he was going to be, like, an atonement to get rid of the law. They just thought he was going to, like, conquer the nations and then they'd be chilling.
For the most part, yeah. They'd be chilling. Yeah, there's different views on what they expected, but it certainly seems like when they were looking towards the Messiah, it was a military conqueror that would bring them out from underneath oppression.
Because, like, in Acts, even when they do believe, like, even the people who do believe he's the Messiah, they still cling to the law sometimes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the law is important. And we kind of bag on it as Christians a little bit, and man, that's kind of silly. But in reality, it is super important to them. It's part of their culture. So I think they just put an unhealthy emphasis on why God had brought the law. So. Yeah, Jimmy.
Is another way to look at the law is like, this is what you should be doing, and then when you can't live up to that, that's where that grace steps in.
They're certainly covered with that, and yeah, you're seeing that built-in process to the system, that there is grace, and there's that ability to do that. So by the way, that's what's fascinating. Immediately after the book of Exodus is what? Leviticus, which is, the whole book is about when you break the law, here's what you do. So the idea that they would think that we're supposed to live this law and able to, the very next book says you're going to break the law, and here's a gazillion chapters on how that process works then, right? So ultimately it's supposed to be an exhaustive process that would lead them to go, you know what? We need a different system. We need a Messiah. So that's kind of the idea. Now, Jews believe the law. Even today, they honor it. And one of the hardest things to do in the midst of evangelism, this is part of their culture. This is part of being Jewish, is obeying the law, right? So to ask somebody to stop following the law is downright offensive to them, right? Or to somehow stop being it's like asking them, hey, I know you're American, but today you're going to be German from now on. It's like, wait a second, this is my heritage and my culture. When I grew up, like, I can't abandon who I am, even if I do believe that Jews are great, or Jesus is great. It doesn't make sense to them. So
is that kind of why the crowd kind of got mad when Paul was like, you know, the Mosaic law, stop?
Yeah, that's the whole argument in Acts 15. Like, the Jews were so passionate about the law, they felt like, man, the Gentiles need to obey the law as well. And Paul finally says, man, no, or Peter, we're not going to put the burden on them that is on us. Like, we can't obey it. Why would we ask them to? And that's why they get passionate about it. So evangelism in a Jewish world is interesting. So obeying the law, because it's Part of your relationship with God is it can be good, but if it's sourced in something else, if I'm going to earn God's favor because of these things, then man, then all of a sudden it gets a little wacky. Okay, so we're going to spend about the next 4 months just reading all 613 laws and just die, right. There's a lot here, so we're gonna skip rocks through some of this. But I want you guys to hear kind of God's heart and God's purpose and why He's giving them these laws and what He's doing in the midst of it. Okay. So this is what's coming. We've seen the kind of the preamble up to verse 6 of him saying, man, this is what you guys are about to get, okay? Now this is kind of cool as well. So they're at the foot of Mount Sinai, verse 7. Let's pick up there.
So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do.
Which is funny. Yeah, this sounds awesome! Right, and so we actually have to do it. And they're like, oh, wait. That was yesterday at church. I don't want to do it anymore on Monday. This is terrible.
It is Monday.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. So, keep
what
rolling.
What did we talk about Sunday?
Forget it.
And Moses brought back the word... And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will come to you in a thick cloud so that the people may hear what I speak with you, and may also believe in you forever.
All right, so I'm going to come. Verse 10, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Get them to wash their garments. Let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down from Mount Sinai in sight of all the people. Y'all pause and get ready. Go take a bath. Get your minds right. Get your hearts right. In 3 days, I'm going to come and deliver the law to you. You need to get ready emotionally, spiritually. God's saying, we're going to pause and let the significance of this moment sink in with all of these people. They're about to hear from God Almighty. So he pauses and does this. We're going to see this several times with the giving of the law, with Leviticus as the priesthood starts. Like God's going to make the priests like sit in silence for a week before they can be kind of inaugurated into the priesthood. Just the idea of reflection and the seriousness of what they're about to do. They're about to enter into a covenant relationship, not with an earthly king, not with a superior, not with that type of relationship, with God Almighty himself. So take it with great seriousness. So Moses reminds the people of that. Verse 12, you shall set bounds for the people all around. Beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. My presence is going to be on top of Mount Sinai. Moses, you will be with me. Tell the people to stay back, because if they touch the mountain, they will die, because of the holiness of God in that moment. I mean, I don't know what this looked like. They're in the middle of freaking nowhere. And the presence of God is going to show up on top of a mountain. And the holiness of God is present. And you're going to see it as like this spectacular show of his strength. And literally the people are supposed to be almost, not fearful, but in awe. And a bit of like, holy cow, this is legit. Like, I'm going to go ahead and stay back, right? I'm going to not do that. Because of the significance of this moment. And God's just telling them, man. Verse 13, no hand shall touch him who will be surely stoned or shot to death. Like the moment of what's going on in this is significant. Okay. Verse 16, it came about on the third day when it was morning, there was thunder and lightning and flashes and thick clouds upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. So when God shows up finally after their preparation, 3 days later, it's on, okay? It is a big ordeal, and their hearts hopefully are on this right spot, okay? 17. Alex, pick it up for me there if you don't mind. 19:17.
Yep. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of the furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently.
I mean, there's some people that believe that literally Mount Sinai would have had to have been like an active volcano, and they placed it on the other side in Midian because of the nature of what happens here. They have found mountains in the area that are scorched on top. Wow. So I don't know. I mean, but just the magnitude of what's going on there, that the people are literally freaking out, probably have never seen anything like this. 19, when the sound of the trumpet grew louder, Moses spoke and God answered him with thunder. I mean, can you guys just see the majesty, the magnitude of this moment?
Revelations.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see something similar to this again when we see the Lord. 21, watch this. He tells Moses, you know what? Let's just make sure everyone's clear on this. Alex, pick up there.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, go down, warn the people, so they do not break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish.
So he's already told him this once. Just go back down and tell him one more time, just in case there was confusion. We're going to see that repeated several times as well. Not even verse 24, the priests are able to come through. Moses, this is you and I on the mountain. Okay, so significant event. They're setting up this covenant relationship. God's going to deliver now in 20 and following, the very beginnings of this. What's fascinating to me about this law and the commandments that God's going to give is they are extremely practical. They are logical. And boy, we look at these and go, man, we would do good to have these in our society. This is not rocket science. But it's amazing when we have strayed from these logical, good, beneficial things that all of a sudden we have trouble in our society. Okay, 20 verse 1. Alex, keep rolling if you don't mind.
Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me.
All right, so to set this up, the first thing we see is I am the higher power. This is called a suzerain vassal, okay, treaty, a higher to a lower, a one in power or a conditional covenant, however you guys want to paint it. So this is different, but it's always set up by the higher power to the lower. This is the nature of our relationship. I'm the boss, you're the employee. Here's how this relationship's going to work. So that's kind of how God sets up this relationship, okay? I am the God. I am demonstrating my power. I'm showing who I am by reminding you that I brought you out of the house of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. I'm the guy who's done this. I'm the one in control. So, first law is what?
You shall have no other gods.
No other gods before me, right? I am God. I am God alone, okay? You think about just the areas of life that these deal with. The first three are going to deal with God, okay? Obviously, this one's dealing with our religion, the gods that we worship, or the God that we worship. The fourth law is going to deal with kind of God and man. And then the 5, 6, 7 through 10 are all going to deal with man's relationship with one another, okay? Humankind and how they deal with one another. So law one, you shall have no other gods before me. I am the only God, okay? Keep rolling. Verse 4.
You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the water under the earth.
All right, what does that mean? What's God saying?
Don't make something up.
Yeah, you're not going to worship anything other than me. Not only are there no other gods, but you're not going to make something to worship in an image that may be tempting for you to worship, right? You saw this in Egypt. They had all these other gods that they worshipped. They all had forms. They were all idols of some sort. You're not going to do this.
So by the picture of Jesus that we worship
all? As long as you don't worship it, paint the picture all you want. In the land that they're about to go into, this is prevalent, right? There were idols everywhere. In the land they came out of, we saw that with Laban and the territories that are around them. This is the nature of the worship of the people around them, right? There are a gazillion gods, and God says, no, there's one. And all these people that worship other gods, they worship him via idols. You're not going to do that. There's one God. It's me. And I'm not in any form. I'm a spirit, right? And you're going to worship me appropriately. So no idols, okay? Keep rolling.
You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children's, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me.
Okay, this is a fascinating verse. What does it mean when God says, you're not going to worship any other gods, for I am a jealous God? When we think of the word jealous, that's usually kind of a petty, childish quality, right? What does God mean when he says, I'm a jealous God?
Jealous for you,
right? I have one wife, right? And if I told Michelle, hey, you're my favorite, but I'm going to have several other wives, she would say to me, no, that's not okay, after she hit me in the face. Because she's jealous for me. She wants all of me. I want all of her. I am unwilling to share my wife as she is unwilling to share me with anybody else. It's not because she's jealous. It's because she's jealous for me. Does that make sense? That's the relationship that God has with his kids. I want all of you. I am jealous for you. I love you. I desire you, right? It's a beautiful imagery of God's covenant relationship with his people. I'm not going to share that. But if Isaiah talks about the Lord alone is God, and he says, I will not share my glory with another. I will not franchise my glory. I will not divide it up among other people. I get it, and I get it alone. So that jealousy is a really cool attribute, okay? So that's the relationship they have with God, okay? Keep going. Pick up in verse 7, Alex.
You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain.
What does that mean? I think we know what it means, or what do you think it means in our current context, right? I grew up hearing that you can't say GD, right? That's what taking the Lord's name in vain is. What does it mean?
I think I remember Shay or might have been you saying that it means to put God's name on something when it has no, like, when the, whatever it is you're promising has, like, no real, like, benefit to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I believe it's the same word that's used in Ecclesiastes. Vapor, emptiness, vanity.
Interesting.
And so it comes from a fact of making the Lord's name empty.
Huh. It's a great picture. But that's the idea. So, like, when you're swearing, I'm going to do this, and you put God's name on that, and then you don't fulfill a promise or what have you, then how have you painted your God? It's in vain. Like, you've damaged my reputation and my name. Don't you dare use me for your business dealings or for personal gain. Don't take my name in vain. I'm to be worshipped. So, Jordan, that's a really cool picture. I'd love to hear, do some word search on that for me. I'd love to hear some more of that etymology, because that's a great word picture of what God's trying to communicate, if that's the case. But that seems to be fitting of what he's saying to them. Don't take my name in vain. Don't make it empty and meaningless in terms of how you communicate me. Okay? So, no other gods before me. No idols. Don't take my name in vain. Those are the first three that all have to deal with our relationship with God. Okay? Now, verse 8, a bit of a transition here, kind of a man and God deal.
Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy.
What does that mean? Stop. Rest. 6 days work, 1 day rest. You guys are going to chill. Okay? That's the example I gave you at the creation. None of that's changed. We need to rest. We need to remember God. Okay? Whether that for you is on Sunday, whether that's, if you're Jewish, Friday night and Saturday, whether you're a pastor and that's on Monday because you work all day Sunday, whether you're, you know, work the swing shift and one day it's Tuesday and the next, whatever. We need to rest. Find your Sabbath. Honor it. Honor God and rest. Make sure that's built into your life. Okay? Keep rolling.
But on the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work for you or your son or your daughter, your male or female servant, or your cattle, or your sojourner who stays with you.
You're going to see in the book of Exodus, God's going to be very clear about what they can and cannot do on the Sabbath. There was a certain distance you could walk on the Sabbath without breaking the Sabbath. And if you walk too far, you broke the Sabbath. That's called work. You walk too far. It's crazy. He's saying, listen, chill, do nothing. Cook your food yesterday and eat it today, but you're not cooking today. That's work, right? Chill. And boy, it's one of the cool traditions when you go to Israel. This is honored by everybody. Shops shut down. It's like trying to go shopping in Mexico at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Everybody's asleep. They're taking a siesta, right? They're resting. Jews do this very well, and it is convicting in our go, 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 faster society. Like, no, we rest. And everybody on Friday is busy, busy, busy because they're shopping. They're finishing up their work week because they know Friday at sunset and it shuts down and we're going to Shabbat. We're going to do nothing. So, really cool.
When they, as in Israel, when they do that Sabbath, what do they do when they say they do nothing?
They spend time with family. So, like, hop in the car and go to the beach? Absolutely. Game on. Go on a hike? Absolutely. Invite all your neighbors over and crush a gigantic meal that takes 4 hours to eat? Absolutely. Watch movies, hang out. They commune. They spend time together. So more religious Jews may have maybe more religious practices, but our guide, Ronan, we were over there 1 year. I mean, he brought us over, some of the leaders, to his house, had his neighbors over, made this gigantic meal, and we just hung out and ate and enjoyed each other. But it's all about this. It's all about community and hanging out and just in resting. So it can take on a number of forms, but everybody does it.
At what point did Christians, like, strip the Jewish tradition out of any traditions, or I don't know what the traditions that were, but like how they have, like, these significant or, like, symbolic gatherings and, like, days and stuff? When do we, like, separate ourselves from that? Because I have some, like, other, like, some mentors and stuff, like a Foursquare. I think, yeah, one of our friends is a Foursquare, and he celebrates a lot of Like, he'll, like, build the tent in his backyard, and, like, train the cars, and, like,
yeah.
do all these things. And, like, he does take time to rest at least once a week. He doesn't have to
yeah.
be, like, you know what I mean? So it's really weird, because he, like, it's not weird. I just never heard of it. Like, non-denominational
yeah. tradition. Yeah, I think some of it is summing up of the law on Jesus and what we're still required to be under and what we're not. I think there's certain traditions that we're supposed to keep. You know, part of with the resurrection and stuff like that, we've changed maybe our Sabbath in honor of that day because that's when it happened. Some of these I think are good pointers. I think to have to keep them, some organizations do it because they see that as earning favor with God. So they need to be done in a way of like, no, I'm doing this as a PS and an and also because I'm in relationship with God.
Yeah.
And sometimes the church is pushed away from that because of the legalism that's behind it and distance themselves from, no, you don't have to. And I think we're kind of coming back to realize, man, some of these are actually really good practices that we can take the idea of and embrace, not to earn God's favor, but because we need to rest. So, yeah, we've jacked up some of these things for sure. But some of them have been done with the wrong motives, and that's when people have to, they need to distance themselves from that. So, that's a good point. Okay. Yep.
Obviously it's one of the like initial 10 commandments, but it's one that our culture, even on a personal level, like I do miserably at. And I kind of feel like there's a greater weight to the 10 commandments. I mean, there's a million small ones, mm-hmm. but I don't pay attention to this one.
Yeah. And that's a good, guys, the 10 commandments are simply the cliff notes of the law. Right? Everything else you're going to get after that fits in with one of these. So you're reading the cliff notes right now, and then we're going to read the whole law. So these are of greatest importance in a sense because they all fit within these. So Sabbath is not something that God's like, no, this is optional. It's on the level of the other 10. So it's a good reminder. And again, that is one of those things and when you immerse yourself in another culture and you realize, oh my gosh, they slow, they stop, they commune. And it's not optional. It's not, yeah, I know that project has to get done. Yeah, I know that paper's got to get written. Sorry, it'll get written Sunday, but not today. So it's convicting. We suck at this as Americans, me included.
I heard it said that even each of these 12 laws fits into two, which is either loving God and loving people.
Yeah.
Would you say that's sort of that God made that to be reflective of like this Edenic communion with God and with other people?
That's it. I mean, that's certainly Jesus' take. What's the greatest commandment? He said, love God, love others, right? Love people. And that he takes the summary statements of the law, Leviticus, whatever it is. But yeah, that's Jesus' Cliff Notes version. If you were to sum it up in two, he says, love God, love others. So absolutely. That's certainly, that seems to be Jesus' take on the entire summation of the law. So
that's what James says as well. He describes it. Okay, if you love others, you know, this sums up all of it,
yeah.
I think, you know, pretty much.
Yeah. Okay.
God bases it. He establishes it on a relationship. Because he says right before he even gives the commandments, he says, remember me.
Yeah.
I'm the one that brought you out of Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about, yeah, this covenant relationship with the Lord. Well, let's pick up there tomorrow. But you guys are getting a feel for the nature and the taste of the law, if you will. Yeah, we'll pick up on more of that in Dominion. Okay.
Mike, help me remember my question. What was it? Oh, yeah. Okay.